will come to order on this Tuesday, April 19th. We will be going in reverse order, starting at the bottom with HJR 36 first, going up to HB 3090, and then finally with HB 3238. At that point in time, once we're done with HJR 36, we'll divide the remaining time equally amongst those two bills, divided by the number of people wishing to testify on it, and then setting the timer based on that. So everybody will be given equal time to testify. This time, I'll open up a public hearing on HJR 36. Please, if you'd read the bill summary.
Mr. Chair and Committee, HJR 36, proposed amendment to the Oregon Constitution to limit appropriations and transfer of monies, allows the Legislative Assembly to exceed limit by 3/5 vote of each House, specifies what constitutes appropriations, exempts certain appropriations, refers proposed amendment to the people for their approval or rejection at the next regular general election.
Thank you, Cletus. At this time, I'll call forward Don McIntyre.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Don McIntyre, nominally representing the Taxpayer Association of Oregon today, and a longtime proponent of some sort of control, reasonable control over state spending. HJR 36 goes in that direction. But I would like to preface your consideration of that with these comments. It's kind of unusual, but the language you see in HJR 36, which is an appropriation limit, was submitted by the sponsor, Representative John Lim, as not an appropriation limit, but a spending limit. You, in the handout there, I believe, you will have a copy of the language that he submitted. I put it in the form that is similar to what you have based on HJR 36. I would ask you at this point to, I don't know how it works mechanically, and Representative Lim would concur with this, is that we would like to see the original language inserted back into the measure as a replacement for the language that's in there now. It's almost inexplicable that the language that went into Legislative Council was in a long time, and then when it did come out, there was a tremendous crush of business. It was past the deadline for refiling anything else, but what they did, they took the original language and changed it considerably, and in fact, to the extent that they made an appropriation limit out of it rather than a spending limit. Do you have a copy of House Bill 30 or HJR 36 amended there?
Amended.
Yeah, good. I don't. Oh, yes, I do. Here we go. Thank you.
Amended?
Yeah, I did. It hasn't really been amended. I just, if you amended it, this would be a sample of the language. What I would like to do is just speak briefly on it and then leave you to consider this. What this measure does, and some of the benefits of it, are this. It does something in controlling the growth of spending to a standard that was established in Colorado. Now, this is not a copy of the Colorado measure table or taxpayer bill of rights, which was adopted by the voters, Colorado voters, in 1992. The differences are, first of all, maybe the biggest difference is that Tabor, the Colorado measure, limits not only state government but every jurisdiction in the state. This measure only limits the growth of spending to the state alone, the state government alone. But the one standard that is the same, it simply says that spending biennium to biennium will not increase at a rate greater than the growth of the state's population and inflation in the 2 years leading up to the biennium. Now, we do have some numbers along those lines, so you can get a feel for what effect that would have. But in the measure itself, in the context of the measure, you'll notice that there's maybe the key part of the measure is that there's a list of spending that could be done by the state that would not be considered spending for the purposes of this measure. There are three really important ones. One is the disbursement of money that the state would receive from the federal government. There would be no limitation, for example, you wouldn't have to count it against the limit for any money that you would refund to taxpayers as refunds or, for example, the kicker. That would not count under the limit. But the most important one, and I think the most appealing exception from spending, is this one that's first on the list, sub A, is that any money that you would set aside for a rainy day fund would not be considered spending. This doesn't mandate that you have a rainy day fund, but if you did, if you had, let's say, that $10 billion or, well, I really should say about $40 billion came in and the limit was $38 billion, then if there's $2 billion extra, that would flow into, if you wanted it to, an emergency fund or a rainy day fund. Now, the interesting part of that is that even though you could put it in a rainy day fund, you couldn't spend it if you were already bumping into the spending limit. But the benefit of that is that as that accumulates, you have a continual safety net, and as a matter of fact, you could conceive of the circumstance where the rainy day fund is getting so big that there would be pressure to spend some of it. Well, that's fine, because when you spend it, you would have to limit the amount you spent from other funds to stay under the limit. So you could, in fact, if that did accumulate, wind up giving the citizens of the state a tax reduction, for example. So that is a feature of the measure that I think you could appreciate. I know that there's a lot of talk about a rainy day fund. Most of the ones I've heard about, if they stand alone, we know how the government works. If you have one all by itself, every day is going to be a rainy day. This would say you've got reserve there, you just can't spend it unless you're under the limit. Now, the limit is reasonable. There's a couple of charts here. The Legislative Fiscal Office did these numbers. Now, they're, you know, naturally, all they are is estimations. But if you took a look at these, the table that says the percentage change over these periods in population and inflation, you can see that in the biennium following 1998, the entire budget, this is all spending, could increase at a rate around 3.5%. Or pardon me, 5.5%. The next biennium, it would be 6.5%, then 3.3%, and then 4% per biennium. Keeping in mind that it doesn't limit all spending, but all spending would be outside of the exceptions. Now, the exceptions give the legislature a great deal of flexibility. Now, the one thing I'll say, pending any questions, is I have heard discussion that, at least in political circles, that the Colorado spending limit is not working very well. But I took a look at that, and others have, and it's working pretty well. I don't know if you noticed in the newspaper today, or I heard it on the radio coming down, but there is an institution in Oregon called the Oregon Progress Board. And the Oregon Progress Board, the headlines today was that Oregon is just average. It's way below average if you compare it to Colorado, that has had a spending limit in place since 1992. So I made a, I went through that little pamphlet, and keep in mind that the Oregon Progress Board is no right-wing pressure group. It's middle of the road establishment, and you'll notice that in I pulled out standards that relate the performance of Colorado to the performance of Oregon, and right at the very top, it shows the ratings out of this 2005 rating book by the Oregon Progress Board. Per capita income in 2003, Colorado ranked 8th, Oregon ranked 29th. Household median income in 2001-2003, Colorado ranked 10th, Oregon 28th, and so on. And in virtually every measure of the citizens' welfare, they're better off in Colorado. So I think that argues against the prohibition of a spending limit. The one thing we know, that if a spending limit is in place, the government doesn't get some of the earnings of its citizens. What happens to those earnings, therefore, the money stays in the private side and it makes jobs. And that is one thing that that is the main point of a spending limit. Because the standard has been, as long as I can remember, is that the way the process works down here is, how much do we have? Let's spend it all. How much can we take out of the economy? Whatever it is comes in, we'll spend it all. This keeps you from spending at all, but only the discipline is not real tough. We did some rough numbers and that should suggest that if this limit had been in place, let's say in 1990, during the decade of the 90s, that 10 years, about $14 billion would have stayed in the economy rather than go to government. Now, that isn't a huge amount of money over 10 years. That's $1.4 billion. And a lot of times when people think about the amounts of money, they're thinking in terms of the general fund. This has to do with all fund spending. All fund spending in this go-around is going to reach $40 billion or better. So we're talking about some significant size spending. So that's essentially it. I hope you like the idea, and if you do, I would like to see you amend HJR 36 with this language, and then I hope there's further discussion on it. I would like to hear from our legislators whether or not they think a spending limit is warranted. But we do know for sure that Colorado has the gold standard of spending limits, and Colorado is way better off.
Thank you, Don. Appreciate you taking the time to come down here and testify. This is Representative Lim's bill, and Representative Lim is out of the country right now. So before I take any further actions or hear any other deliberation, we'll wait till Representative Lim comes back out of courtesy to him. But I think the committee is going to discuss this. I think that you bring up some great points and provide some substantial documentation to warrant at least the discussion on this. So we will definitely be bringing it back, and my colleagues and I will discuss it in length further. And when Representative Lim returns,
thank you very much.
Thank you, Don. I see nobody else wishing to testify on HJR 36.
Any questions on the witness, or will he be back later?
Well, in the name of time, I think with Representative Lim, I think it'd be more beneficial with him. I know Don will come back to testify on it as well, but at least Representative Lim will be in the discussion in totality. Is that okay?
No, it's fine. Although my assumption is it's Mr. McIntyre's bill that Representative Lim has implemented since he's commenting on how it came out. And if there is a chance to discuss it with him at a future date, that would be good.
And I know Don's. Don, you have email and everything?
Pardon me?
Do you have email?
Oh, sure.
Would you mind writing that down for the committee? And I'll
Well, I'd like to discuss on the record, not in an email exchange.
Okay. And you'll have your chance. Thank you. HCR 36, we'll close the public hearing.
Which one? Is Jerry here yet? Can you call Rusty and Criminal's office and find out where he's at?
I got it. I understand that.
Did I see Dawn Phillips here?
Here a minute ago.
Is she, can you see if Representative Criminal's out in the hall? We'll hear his bill next. Committee will stand at ease. Representative Crummell, Representative Thatcher. Welcome to Representative Crummell. Representative Thatcher, you know you're always welcome.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Whether you like it or not.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was on my way down when I heard so. I tried to get here as quick as I could. I thank you for holding things up for me. I'm, for the record, State Representative Jerry Criminal, House District 26.
And Jerry, before you get into your testimony, I'm going to have Cletus read the summary of the bill.
Mr. Chair and Committee, HB 3090 provides that ballots rejected by vote tally system may not be counted, prohibits election official from modifying ballot cast by elector, directs county clerks to develop security procedures governing counting of ballots, requires that ballots be stored in secure locations, prohibits opening of return identification in secret envelopes any election conducted by mail until 8:30 a.m. on date of election, prohibits ballot drop sites established by a person other than elections officials, directs county clerks to provide training for persons who watch receiving and counting of votes, specifies that ballot may not be counted as part of recount unless ballot was counted in original tally of ballots. Committee, please note that there were amendments issued and a hand in gross of dash two amendments are included in your packet today.
Thank you, Cletus. Now, Representative, for the record.
Okay, for the record, State Representative Jerry Criminal, House District 26, which is Wilsonville, Sherwood, and over to Gaston, so I have Southern Washington County. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for hearing House Bill 3090 today. I just have a few brief comments about it, and Representative Thatcher also has some comments, and we'd very quickly like to kind of walk you through the bill. This bill really is about ballot integrity and making sure that that when people drop their ballots off for mail elections, that the drop sites are secure, giving voters peace of mind that and a vote of confidence that the system is secure and that in fact when they turn their ballot in, it will be placed in a place where then when it's time to count, the votes will be counted. One of the primary goals of House Bill 3090 is to increase the integrity of the ballot drop sites. And we've heard stories about ballot drop sites, for example, at the Oregon City Library. It was closed on the Monday before election, but there was a guy standing out front with a cardboard box covered with a particular candidate's stickers and collecting ballots and telling voters that he was just doing his civic duty. Well, you know, I guess first of all, if a voter's going to hand their ballot to him, that's, you know, kind of sort of shame on them, I guess. But at the same time, having the ability to just sort of stand out there and collect ballots when he, you know, maybe he turned them in and maybe he didn't, but we may never know. And at Chemeketa Community College, a group of young Republicans set up a table and a box gathering ballots, and again, but they refused to put up a big sign that said it was not an official drop site, and it was not an official drop site. So again, in this kind of a situation, if somebody hands in their ballot, did it really get to the county for actual processing? And in a lot of respects, our vote by mail has become a vote by drop box. And I think that that's one of the things that we need to be very, very careful of with the way that we are now voting in Oregon. Drop boxes really are about convenience for people. Not that the post office isn't convenient, but it's pretty convenient that if you're going to the library anyway to be able to drop your ballot off, if you're going to go pay your water bill anyway at City Hall, being able to drop your ballot off, if you're going to go to some other sort of a place, being able to drop your ballot off, it really is a convenience sort of a factor. And more drop sites also, in especially in the larger counties, it would really help cut down on, it can help cut down on the lines that form on election night. So what I'd like to do is turn it over to Representative Thatcher, and she can hit on a couple of things that she would like to talk about, and then we'll be glad to sort of walk you through the bill with the amendments added into it.
Thank you, Representative. Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members, fellow committee members. I'm just going to briefly touch on an experience that I had just in the voting process since vote by mail was instituted. I went to my ballot drop site because it was close to election day and I didn't trust that it would get there in time. So I went there. I was expecting to put my ballot into a locked box of some sort of a secure drop box for the ballot. But instead, I handed it to whoever walked up to the counter at the Water Bureau, and she tossed it into a recycle bin that was on top of a file cabinet. I've never done that again because I didn't feel like it was a very secure type of Dropbox. And this bill, House Bill 3090, calls for increased security, eliminates also the stray ballots in the recount process to help reduce chances of what is happening right now in Washington State. We essentially don't want a few hundred ballots to show up mysteriously under a water cooler a month after the election has been certified. We recently heard at the Dorchester Conference, Washington gubernatorial, I can't say that very well, GOP candidate Dino Rossi. He urged us to act now because, and I quote, he didn't want Oregon to be the butt of all the jokes on late night television shows like Washington State is today. And that's essentially what we're trying to do, is address some of these problems up front. Thank you.
You can also say candidate for governor.
Okay. Yes. Yes.
He's trying to help.
That would work, Mr. Chair. Well, what we'd like to do, if you'll indulge us, is just very quickly kind of take you through the sections of the bill in terms of and let you know what the bill does. And this is with the amendments. We have worked with the county clerks, and I think there are some county clerks here today that are going to testify, hopefully in favor of this bill. But we have worked with them to.
They are in favor of this. I think this is the first time. my goodness!
But we did work with them on the amendments for this bill to try to address some of the concerns that they had, while at the same time addressing some of the concerns that Representative Thatcher and I wanted to address with the bill as well. So, Section 1, you'll notice it will increase the limits on how ballots can be enhanced by election workers. And what in other words, when the choice is very clear, that the voter's intent is very clear, but an enhancement will make it readable by the ballot tally machinery, then the election worker can enhance the ballot. However, when the voter intent is not clear, then the worker cannot just sort of presume what the voter intended, and then that would be an undervote in that particular election, or for that particular election, understanding all of the different candidates and issues. Section 2. And by the way, the enhancement is allowed when board members from different political parties have viewed it and they agree basically on the enhancement. The Section 2 is the county clerk's security plan, and just adds that the security procedures governing the timing, location, and method of tallying ballots has to be included as part of the clerk's security plan that they have in place now.
You want me to take it on? Okay. Section 4 deals with securing the ballots, storing them in a secure location designated by the county clerk, and limiting access to only those authorized by the county clerk. And Section 6 makes it so that only the county clerks would be authorized to set up drop sites. They would be the official drop sites, and unauthorized drop sites would be prohibited. Official drop sites would be staffed by elections officials who are those designated by the county clerk as such. And they must be staffed during official drop site hours. In other words, when you go to the library, somebody at the library will have charge over that ballot box. Somebody will be responsible, essentially. Except for permanent receptacles that look like the mailbox is secured to the ground that we've all seen. And tied to that, I would like to talk about Section 10, the very last part. Section 10 ties in with this section in that it would make it a Class C felony to tamper with any of this ballot drop sites. And this would... There were some concerns raised about these mailbox-style drop sites being not secure because somebody could just drop a match in there. Because if you're in a particular district, you kind of know how that district might be voting that would be dropping ballots in that site. But there really is little in the existing law that would make it that would discourage that type of activity. And this would bring it up to the same level as if somebody were tampering with a mailbox, post office box. And then when you go to the library, and they're closed on the Monday before, this having notice of the actual hours that the ballot drop sites are open, and then a warning that if ballots are left outside of these hours, it's at the elector's own risk. And this would be answering the situations where people would squeeze their ballots between the two glass doors on the closed library, and you know, I don't know if they got counted or not. I just hope that I just don't know that people believe that that wasn't a drop site because the library is a drop site. So therefore, that's they're making it their own drop site. And I saw other people's ballots laying there. Therefore, it attracted more. And alongside that, you would have individuals setting up unofficial drop sites right outside the library. You didn't know who they were, but it looked official because, after all, the library was an official drop site.
So the other thing with regards to drop sites is it does have, as part of Section 6, is that if a county, it has numbers, population numbers for the county. So if a county has over 35,000 electors, it must have one site for every 20,000. And if a county has under 35,000 electors, then it must have one drop site, at least one. Now, they can set up, the county clerks can set up as many drop sites as they want to. That's not the, but they have to have at least one drop site, depending on their population counts. And then it does also, the bill also increases the penalties for destroying, removing, damaging, or otherwise tampering with a place of deposit. And I think Representative Thatcher already mentioned that. Section 8 calls for the county clerks to provide training for observers watching the ballot counting process so that after the election occurs and when people are going to be going in and watching, observing the counting process and that sort of thing, the county clerks will train them as far as what to look for, what sorts where they can stand, where they can't stand, what they can do. Because the other thing is, we don't want the observers. We want the observers observers there, and we want them to be able to see what's going on. What we don't want to have happen, though, is to have the observers getting in the way of the workers being able to do the work that needs to be done. So it's a real balancing act there. But I think that the way this is provided here, that it gives the county clerks the ability to train those folks. And then Section 9 talks about recounts, and that recounts cannot use ballots not counted in the original count. Now, in the original count, what that means is the original certified count. So that's not what happens on necessarily election night. You know, in other words, to say, well, if a ballot didn't get counted on election night, it can't be counted. No. It's part of the original count that is certified as the results of the election, and that's how the bill addresses it. And then Section 10, as Representative Thatcher already mentioned, is and talked about, is the Class C felony calls for, and then any other penalties are civil penalties for violation of election laws. That's the bill. And we hope that you will look favorably upon the bill, and hope that you will send it to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you, Representatives. I had one question. Section 1, sub 4, take it from line 11 through 19. If, in fact, somebody doesn't agree, the Republican, the Democrat, on the intent of the voter, and they just don't agree, the ballot's not counted, it's not enhanced?
It's not
no,
enhanced.
It's not enhanced, it would not be counted, it would not, and that would be an undervote in that particular race.
So, for argument's sake, what if, in fact, it's fairly obvious, but the machine wouldn't count it, needs to be darkened, like you're saying? Let's say they voted for John Kerry. They were misguided. They believed the commercials. And they voted for John Kerry, and it didn't get counted. He comes, and I'm that Republican, and I just don't agree. I think the person was misguided. What they meant to do was, would that, in fact, disqualify that ballot in that situation?
I don't think so, Mr. Chair. I think that what you're looking at, if you can see, for example, some of the counties use a connect the. Oh, here we go. I don't know if we can turn this on or not, but some of the counties use a.
We've all seen the ballots.
Oh, okay.
Here.
So they connect the arrows. Now, if it's really clear that the voter put a line across there, that's pretty clear, and it just wasn't dark enough to be picked up by the machine, then the worker ought to be able to, but both parties need to observe that that's exactly what the situation is, and that arrow is being enhanced. What isn't going to be clear is that like on this particular one, it's got Harry Brown and Art Oliver and then Patrick Buchanan. It's got it. So somewhere out here in this area in the margin, or somewhere over in here, the person just writes a smiley face. I mean, if the intent is not there, if you can't tell the intent as far as who they were voting for, then the ballot shouldn't count, and it shouldn't come back in later. You shouldn't be able to come back in later and say, "Well, we weren't sure on this one, but we're going to count it anyway." And I think that's one of the problems that both Florida in 2000 and Washington in 2004 found themselves in, is that the intent of the voter may not have been clear. Now, Washington had some other problems, like finding ballots under water coolers and that sort of thing. Ballots, and that's why the one section deals with ballots that are not part of the original certified count do not become part of the recount.
Okay.
Does that answer your question, Mr. Chair?
It does answer my question. I do think that the potential there, I mean, if something is kicked, by the way that it's written, if something is kicked out because the machine was not able to read it, it goes to a clarification process. The clarification process that it goes to has one Republican and one Democrat, and by the wording is, if they don't agree, it's not counted. And if I'm misreading that, then please tell me. But my point there is, if it's apparent but not readable, it then goes to the discussion factor of the two parties, where by the language I think you may or may not have. Because if in fact I don't agree, I just don't agree. Then you're not getting agreement, therefore it wouldn't be counted. I think that could be applicable whether you voted for John Kerry or you voted for George Bush or for Derek Kitts or Eric Kitts.
I don't agree.
I do.
Or if you voted for Derek Kitts.
And if you did that, then it's okay. And I would encourage, my county clerk who's here to interpret that the way that she should. But you see the what I'm getting at there. Mm-hmm. I'm not trying to make a mockery of it. But what I'm saying is that by the language, if it's kicked out, the machine didn't read it, it goes to the interpretation process of one Republican, one Democrat at least, opposite parties, and if in fact they don't get agreement, it's discarded. So that was my only, and I don't know how you tighten up that language to because you're going to have to, the trust factor does have to come into play. I just think that by the way that it was written, that opens itself up to, you could clearly see it was John Kerry, but I'm a Republican, and it got kicked out. Therefore, now, based on the way this is written, it goes to two people to interpret it. And if I don't agree, whether it's a rational or not rational thought, then that vote's not counted. I just want to be very careful of that.
I just want to say, Mr. Chair, that there are procedures in process right now. I'm not sure if it's just one of each party. It's an election board. They just can't all be members of the same party. That is what it says. And I think that the county clerks could address how they would implement that after we're finished here.
Mr. Chair, the other fail-safe there is that I think it's in Section 9, which we didn't really address, but in Section 9 there is a point that says unless ordered by a court, a ballot may not be counted in any recount conducted under this chapter, so on and so forth. But and the point there is that just like you were talking about, if you've got someone that decides they're going to be obstinate as an elections board worker, and they just say no to everything that looks like it's against them, and yes to everything that, well, you could always take it to court, and the county clerk can do that. Could take it to court and say, you know, I need to have direction from the court as to whether or not I can put this in a recount situation.
Okay, so there are
some fail safes there,
okay,
that allow for someone else to have, so that you know if you do get an obstinate elections worker.
And I wouldn't. I'm not suggesting that anybody would be that partisan that they would try to discount another party's votes. I would never imply that, infer that, or try to do it myself. Representative Greenlee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Paul, do you have a question?
I have. I think there are some important things here that interest me, but there are a couple of things that are bothering me a lot. Can you specifically say what it means that a person may not establish or place a deposit for ballots cast in the election?
Where are you speaking of, Representative?
I'm on, I'm on the hand engrossed, I'm on page 2 of the hand engrossed version, and I'm on line, try to tell what line I'm on.
Right. 11-12-23,
Section 6, which sub?
Section 6 is what I'm talking about. I have a couple of questions in Section 6, Part 1.
Sub 6 of Section 6? So the person may not destroy, remove, damage, or otherwise
tamper? Section 6, Part 1.
In an election conducted by mail, a person, except an elections official in performance of their duties, may not establish a place for deposit of ballots cast in the election. I wonder what that means.
Okay, what that means is that the only person that can establish an official ballot drop site is the county clerk.
Yeah, but what about unofficial is the question?
Set up an unofficial drop site for ballots, you would be in violation of the law.
So
if this bill passes...
Well, the question is, a person may not establish a place of deposit other than election official. And that means I can't say to my wife, well, I'll take your ballot in?
Sure. No, you...
Well,
no,
am
that's,
I not,
not, the, that's not the same. Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
I can't say to the people on my call.
Let him answer the question.
If you're going to take your wife's ballot to the drop box now, is there a reason why your wife wouldn't trust you to drop her ballot off?
Absolutely.
Representative Marks is nodding, so maybe that's a bad example.
I mean, there may be a reason that you might not trust me to take my wife's ballot.
My wife would, for example, trust me to drop her ballot off, and so if she wanted me to drop it off for her, that would be fine. What it's saying is that a person other than the county clerk cannot establish an official drop site. And if you set up an unofficial drop site, you actually will still be in violation because a bill does not it does not allow people to set up unofficial drop sites. In other words, you couldn't take a cardboard box, set it up out in front of the out in front of your house, and say here's a drop site.
That'd be an unofficial drop site. You can bring it
and you would be in violation of the election.
We had a lot of discussion. There's a lot of discussion with legislative council about that, because I raised that exact issue. I thought, you know, I don't want to outlaw my husband bringing my ballot down to the drop site or mailbox, whatever. And so in discussions with legislative council, what we're trying to do is not have unofficial drop sites set up for the purpose of gathering them from the random public. You know, in other words, that have the appearance of an official drop site. And that was the whole point. But there are also situations where people have ballot parties, voting parties, whatever, and they go there for the purpose of, celebrating whatever their candidate and casting a box. So it's not meant for the general public. It was an invitation event, or like you're saying, you're handing your ballot to your wife.
Follow up.
Yeah, I do want to get to that gathering. So if I put a sign up in my front of my house and say there's going to be a gathering today from 8 in the morning to 6 tonight to collect ballots, that would be okay?
I suppose so.
I mean, what is a gathering?
Well, you're inviting people to come to your house, I guess, or an event or a place specifically for that purpose.
Is there a definition in statute of a gathering?
Are you unclear what a gathering is?
Yes, I am.
We could talk to legislative council about defining that more precisely. Like I said, we were having difficulty actually trying to convey that, and apparently maybe it needs a little bit more work in that particular section.
Yeah, I really think it does. I mean, I'm worried about
Mr. Chair and Representative Greenlee. If you read section 6, sub 1, all the way through, it says that a person may not set up a place of deposit for ballots cast in the election. It says this subsection does not prohibit the collection of ballots at a gathering at which a place of deposit for ballots is not otherwise provided. In other words, there were reports last November, for example, of people going to a bar and having a ballot party. Now, my own personal feeling is, if somebody is stupid enough to go to a bar and drop their ballot into a box and they have no idea what the disposition of those ballots is going to be, they get what they deserve. I mean, that's flat out. That's their own stupidity, and they get what they deserve. Now, on the other side of that, if you got a bunch of friends that are getting together and they're having a ballot party, this section does not prohibit them from getting together and dumping their ballots into a box and somebody taking it to the county clerk's office or somebody taking it to a ballot drop site, an official drop site, and dropping the ballots in.
But does it prohibit that gathering at the bar?
No. No, it wouldn't. But that's what I'm saying. If they're stupid enough to do that, then that's up to them. I would not treat my ballot that way, personally. But that's me personally. But there are people out there that, they want to have a party and they want to have tell people to bring their ballots. And, maybe it's a bunch of Republicans that want to get together and, okay, everybody come on over and we'll all mark our ballots together and toss them in a box. Or maybe it's a bunch of independents or a bunch of Democrats or, whoever that want to get together and have it. It's not going to be, because that's not setting up an unofficial drop site. Somebody setting up an unofficial drop site is somebody going out and sitting at a table in front of the transit mall and
the big sign, a transit mall gathering.
With a big sign that says drop your ballot.
Says this is a transit mall gathering. Please drop your ballot.
Well, I guess they could do that. I wouldn't advise it, but anyway. And where it's really going to come into play, Mr. Chair and Representative Greenlee, is if somebody can.
All right, thank you, Representative Baldy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kremel or Thatcher, I guess, when we talk about the place of deposit shall be staffed during all hours that the that the place of deposit is open.
What are you referencing, Representative?
This is in Section 6, Line 17.
Thank you.
I'm just curious. We've got a clear definition of what the permanent drop boxes are, as opposed to a deposit that's going to have to be staffed. And is that spelled out, I guess, somewhere that we have a really clear description of what a good drop box is?
Mr. Chair and Representative Holy, if you when you're talking about line 17, the place of deposit should be staffed during all hours that the place of deposit is open. That's referring to, for example, Wilsonville Library is an official drop site that has been set up by the Clackamas County Clerk's Office. There is an official bag there and that sort of thing. And what it's saying is that drop site is staffed. There's somebody there at the desk that's been trained by the clerk's office to basically watch that deposit, to watch that site. And that site is open whatever the library hours are. So, and that's what it's saying there, is that it has to be, is that the place of deposit has to be open when the place of deposit is open. In other words, the county clerk can't tell the city of Wilsonville that they have to open their library from 8 in the morning to 8 at night, or from 7 in the morning to 9 at night, or any of that. It's whatever, so the hours of that place of deposit are whatever the hours are that are set by the city of Wilsonville. Now, down from that, then, is that the county clerk can also set up permanent receptacles that do not have to be staffed. And we have several counties that actually have done that. They have, whether they bought, and I think some of the clerks will talk about this, but they've got, for example, used postal boxes or like postal boxes that they have installed. They're concreted into the ground. They are set up. They are ballot drop sites. They're not mailboxes. They are ballot drop sites, and they're used solely for elections. And we wanted to make sure, because of the issue that was brought up by the Clerks Association with regards to these permanent drop sites not having to be staffed and making sure that they were okay to do, we put that section in. So a couple of lines down, actually it would be at Section 6, sub 3, sub 3. It says a county clerk may establish permanent receptacles as places of deposit for ballots in an election conducted by mail. A permanent receptacle is not required to be staffed as required under subsection 2 of this section. A permanent receptacle shall be locked, secured to the ground, and secured from being moved or tampered with. And that's the county clerks were fine with that when we had talked with them before. I don't want to put words in their mouth, but they were fine with that when we had talked with them about that before. And it met the need that they had from the standpoint of having these permanent receptacles out there that they wanted to make sure that they could use.
Follow real quick.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr.
I'll try to keep my answer.
I guess where I was going is do we have rules or regulations around a temporary receptacle that the staff places have that they actually deposit their ballots into? Is that something that's covered by rule or I mean, is it a locked receptacle that they use, a bag or what? I just wasn't familiar with that.
Mr. Chair and Representative Holvey, I think that would probably be a question better addressed by the clerks. I'm not trying to, sort of pass the buck here, but I think that they, because they work with this stuff all the time,
okay. And
I think that they can really give you the more accurate information about what the rules are and that sort of thing. I mean, from the standpoint of the statutory stuff, our goals are being met with this language, and I think that it gives the clerks enough, it gives them direction, but at the same time gives them the ability to work within it so that they can set up their receptacles the way they need to.
Thank you, Representatives. I think you've answered the question. I think some of the other questions that you may have can be addressed if the other people.
So, could I ask one more question?
No, not right now.
Well, then I'd like to put a statement on the record, if I may.
That's right. We got tons of people, so feel free to make your statement. At the same time, I'll call forward the next witnesses, Annette Newingham and Gwyneth Van Carlson, if you'll come forward.
Go now?
Go.
I think we ought to make clear on the record what we have in mind with the Section 9, the question of having a ballot counted only if it was counted in the original. I mean, I'm not sure The reason why I ask questions, I'm not sure if the sponsors really intended to take out the possibility that in a recount we might find a significant number of ballots that should, that were legitimate ballots cast by our citizens and intended to be counted in an election, that we would, I was hoping they weren't intending specifically to exclude that from a possible recount, and it is an issue we can take up as we continue to discuss that.
Thank you. Net?
Hi, this is Annette Newingham. I'm here on behalf of the Association of County Clerks, and for the first time this legislative session, I'm in support of a bill here.
We're adjourned.
Yeah. I thought you would like that. I would also like to address some of the issues that came up in the discussion. I think I can provide some clarity to that. That's outside of my testimony. My testimony is fairly brief. The first section was dealing with the amendment, which has been addressed in the Second Amendment, so that's good. It's still adding the or duplicate. The one significant change to the bill itself is it deals with the unofficial drop locations. And because there's been quite a bit of discussion, I do want to talk about that to some extent. The unofficial drop sites continue to be a problem in the sense of perceptions by the public. This is something that all election officials receive many calls by the media, the public, not quite understanding how that's allowed. And that's a real important issue. And I say perceptions because most of the problems, at least from my experience with that, is it's because they're collecting it. They don't have a sign that says it's an official drop site. A good example is I had to go personally out to the university campus three different times, two different groups, different party. I mean, it's not any particular group. Everybody's really well-intentioned, but it just has caused some problems for people feeling not secure about the ballot process. Election officials don't have a lot of control over that issue. We're sort of just have to deal with it when people call and question whether they can or they can't. And frankly, I've been pretty vocal on this issue, and I know that my peers have been as well, to tell them that we do not support that, giving, you know, your ballot. I wouldn't take my ballot to an unofficial site. We the election officials in the state have been tried to be very supportive of having adequate drop locations. I think it's addressed in this bill as to how many, which does deal with that issue. We want to be sure that we do give convenience to the voters and that they can turn in their ballot by mail or at one of the official drop sites to make sure that we give everybody an opportunity to vote in every election. But we also want to be sure that the integrity of the election process is upheld, and that's extremely important to election officials. So for that reason, we do support this amendment and the bill itself eliminating unofficial drop locations. A couple of other things that were brought up on this is one of the discussions was about enhancing in the two people and Chair Kitts, you brought this issue up. I would like to really emphasize that we have a vote by mail manual, and that vote by mail manual actually outlines the different circumstances that we encounter and provide rules on when we are to process ballots and enhance it and when we are not supposed to. I support the legislative change to put that in there to help people know that there is a high level of integrity in the elections process. It just makes it that much stronger. But the rule itself does give us guidelines, and we train the staff to follow those guidelines. So they don't just make independent decisions without guidelines. I thought that might be reassuring to you. I also want to clarify that if there is an issue where the intent is not clear and the ballot is not enhanced or duplicated as a result of that, the ballot is counted. It's just that contest will reflect whatever that voter did or didn't do. It's only when the case is that the intent is clear that the whole ballot would be duplicated or that particular contest enhanced to reflect the intent of the voter. But in all cases, the ballots are counted. We would not reject an entire ballot because one contest had a problem. And I thought that was important to clarify that. I also want to bring up on Section 6, where the Section Sub 4 that talks about how many mail receptacles that we would be required to have, which I certainly have no problem with that, but would like to clarify that if we had less than a county-wide, I would assume that what we're talking about where it says in each county with 35,000 or more electors in the county, if we had like a district in Lane County, for instance, which is over 200,000 voters, but we only had the city of Coburg that had an election, that we would then fall into the guideline of the 35,000. And that wasn't totally clear, and I didn't realize that till today. But I think that seems logical, but if there's something contrary to that, we would really need to know that. As to the contest of election, and not counting the ballots, the reason why the Association of County Clerks did support not counting ballots found in a recount that were not counted in the original count is because we do have, and others have, the right for a contest of election. And so if there was something like, for instance, let's just say that Lane County had a recount, and at the point that we were recounting, we found some kind of error that resulted in some ballots not being counted. We, as the county clerk of my county, I would have the ability through the statutes to take that and file a contest of election with the reasons why, and the judge would ultimately make that decision. So it doesn't eliminate the possibility of those ballots being counted, but it would there would be a course of action that would the courts could make that final decision, so it would eliminate some of the chaos possibly found in Washington State. And I think that is the end of my testimony. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Thank you, Annette.
Yeah, that last point. But that happens under the current statutes, is that right?
Yes, Chair Kitts, Representative Greenlake, yes, that is under the current statutes, but I do not find that this would change that. The contest of election is not changed in this bill.
Thank you.
Representative Marshall Holby.
Thank you. In the dash two, as you mentioned, the county clerk with the election of a like Coburg, say, would you want to see that change to say something in the effect of in each election with 35,000 or more electors in the jurisdiction, the county clerk shall maintain something along those lines? Is that?
Yeah, Chair Kitts, Representative March, I would suggest that clarity be given on that if it's possible to find some, you know, amendments to that effect, because I'm sure that if we only had, because the city of Coburg is like 500 voters, to have, you know, all 30 drop sites open probably wouldn't really serve a good purpose.
500 voters and 499 cops. Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Annette, back to the place of deposit that shall be staffed during all hours, you know, in a particular receptacle, I suppose, is there that fits your rules. Is there going to be or will there be some sort of impact, you know, fiscally to the counties for doing that? Is that something different than they do now?
Chair Kitts, Representative Holby, I don't believe that there will be a fiscal impact, and the reason why, and through the discussion, County Clerk from Linn County, Steve Druckenmiller, and myself met with Representative Thatcher and Representative Crummell, and we talked through the bill, and which I wanted to say that I appreciated them taking the time to listen to some of the concerns that we did have. And one of the things was the drop sites and the staffing issue. And we already have representatives that are at all those locations, like, for instance, the library. And what we can do is add a higher level, and we can deputize the people that are there. I have done so in the past for some circumstances. At one particular library, I did deputize staff to be able to handle the ballots. We then maintain control, we the election officials, to make sure that the people are adequately trained at those locations. We might not pay them. It might be a volunteer basis or something, but we can provide the adequate training, and then also do the deputization, perhaps, if we feel that's appropriate, and to make sure that they follow the rules that they need to follow. So I don't think that we would experience a fiscal impact. Most of the time, the people that do this, like we have city recorders that do it, it's helping their community, so they usually do it out of the goodness of their heart in most cases. And if not, we're already paying them.
Representative Marsh, do you have a question?
I'm sure.
Great. Seeing no further questions, appreciate it.
All right. Thank you.
Gwyneth?
Hi.
Can you state your name for the record?
I'm Gwyneth Van Frank Carlson. And good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. And I'd like to thank the two representatives who sponsored this bill and all the work that the county clerks have done to help amend the bill. I'm here representing LILA, Lane Independent Living Alliance, which is a group of, by, and for people with disabilities. I represent a cross-section of people with all kinds of challenges, and from going blind and not knowing it yet and marking your ballot incorrectly. That's a real easy thing to do. Cognitive impairments can cause that kind of an error to happen. And I really, really appreciate the work that's been done to amend this bill to make clarifications so that those kinds of errors can be corrected and these votes can be counted. So I really appreciate and support this bill. And also appreciate the work that the Secretary of State's office is doing with the legislature on making voting more accessible to me and to the population I represent. Thanks.
You're welcome. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you.
My colleagues, we are rapidly running out of time. I know there are a lot of people signed up to testify on House Bill 3238. So we have five other people wishing to testify on this bill. If any of those five people have written testimony, if they'd be willing to submit for the record, it'd be greatly appreciated so that we can give adequate time to the next bill as well. I will tell you that we probably will not move 3090 at this time. We'll probably be bringing it back so that we can get some clarifications on some of the issues that have been raised. So if that gives anybody less heartburn, we'll probably be bringing it back early next week for the gathering and some of the other stuff and questions that have been raised. So at that time, John Kaufman and Kathy Eaton.
Chair Kitts, members of the committee, I will be very brief with my testimony today on House Bill 3090. For the record, my name is Kathy Eaton. I'm the governance chair for the Legal Women's Voters of Oregon. We originally had planned to come to vigorously oppose this bill the way it was written. We're very much pleased with the amendments that have taken place. And what I do want to do is to ask a question with regard to Section 9 in the original bill, which talks to the authorization of people to watch and review the election procedures and the fact that the county clerks will provide training for those persons. The one question that we had to ask is whether or not those people who are authorized observers will agree to be trained. People will authorize them to do that, to participate. The county clerks will provide training, but there's nothing in there that says that those people will indeed agree as part of that authorization to receive that training.
Representative Thatcher, do you want to answer that question if you're able at this time?
Sure, Mr. Trickett. Section 9, as I see, are you in subsection?
I'm in subsection 2 at the very end, 3. The county clerk shall provide training for persons authorized to watch the receiving and counting of a section of this section. And we're suggesting that perhaps some wording such as authorized observers shall agree to be trained in order to participate, something like that.
That would be the intention.
Right. It's the intention, but it isn't said, so, you know.
Okay, so got, wording change.
Yeah.
To make it
if
more
you could,
clear.
If you could look at that,
yeah,
we would appreciate that.
Email that That'd suggestion to both the authors of the
okay.
bill. That way you can document your suggestion.
Other than that, we're very pleased with the changes and appreciate the work that went into it. Thank you.
Thank you. John?
Mr. Chairman, I'm John Kaufman, Multnomah County Elections Director, committee members. I'll just say a couple things. And interestingly, Kathy, I was going to talk about the same section, section 9, sub 3. Just to say that it is always my desire to have people present to observe our process. I think that the system is well served by having people present so that they do see what happens. I think a lot of issues out there are raised because people haven't actually seen what's going on. And if you would let your committee administrator address the committee, I think he could speak to what he observed in Multnomah County at the last general election. So I don't mind at all providing training for persons. I do think Kathy's suggestion is a good one, too, that the people who are authorized by various groups to observe agree to be trained. And apart from that, I think I also wanted to comment on Section 1 regarding the issue of enhancing or duplicating ballots. In my nearly 30 years in the elections business in Oregon, I have not yet seen inspection teams doing other than their best to make sure that the voter's intent is indeed read by the computer. You have some examples from Yamhill County. I can give you examples from Multnomah County using the oval, how people sometimes will write notes to us and say, I didn't mean to do that. Or they'll scribble across an entire ballot, and their scribbling without their intent actually runs through an oval and would be picked up as a count on an issue. It's something that we do, and I think we do very well. And also to echo Annette's comment, thanking Representative Thatcher and Representative Crummell for their work with this bill.
Hey, thank you. Appreciate your testimony for the record. At this time, we will call forward Joe Hobson, Rick Bennett, and Diana Evans, I think.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Rick Bennett representing AARP Oregon. Just wanted to say that, as introduced, we would have been opposed to this legislation specifically due to Section 1, Subsection 3A, related to a ballot being rejected by a vote tally system, feeling that that could have a disproportionate effect related to older voters who might press too hard, not hard enough, or some other way mark their ballot that might cause it to be rejected and then not counted.
Rick, in the essence of time,
yes,
I appreciate
I'm
it. I just wouldn't state why you would have objected if you could just state what your
it's my point. Understanding and a quick read of the amendment and conversations with others here in the audience that concern has been resolved, I believe, and so as amended we would be in support of the bill.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
My name is Joe Hobson from living in the Kaiser area. Originally I was very strongly opposed to this particular bill because of its ramifications on the very successful vote by mail. But since the amendments have been proposed and I assume adopted, it has improved it tremendously. And coming from an area where is the second largest county in the state of Oregon to a Kaiser area where people are quite thick, is quite a difference, and I think that this vote by mail process has been one of the greatest things since you all heard sliced bread. And I have a written statement that I'll submit for the record.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks.
Appreciate it. Diane?
I'd just like to say that I've been interested in elections for many, many years, and I think I've worked the precincts. I've done all of the sort of thing that somebody who is interested in politics does. And I had some concerns when it came to the security of ballots. And when you hear the stories about people dropping ballots in libraries that are closed, I think that the improvements that have been made in this bill are very helpful. And I also am very pleased to see that that the county clerks, and I happen to say, I have never worked in a situation as I did this last election, because I live in Marion County, and I was asked to be trained and go watch on election days when they were counting. And I give high plaudits to what happened in Marion County. It was very helpful. And I certainly hope the bill, as it's been amended, will pass.
And now that you've testified, can you state your name for the record?
Oh, my name's Diana Evans. I live in Salem at 1910 Madrona Avenue South, Salem. And I guess that's all you need.
That is what I needed at the beginning, but hey, you know.
In a beautiful house, Mr. Chairman, with a beautiful piece of property.
Thank you. And thank you for being here and testifying today. I really appreciate it. Colleagues, it's been asked that we move the dash two amendments into this bill before we bring it back. Would there be objection from that? I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3090 and open a work session on House Bill 3090.
Mr. Chair, I move we adopt the dash two amendments to House Bill 3090.
Mr. Representative Thatcher moves that we adopt the dash two amendments into House Bill 3090. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Anita.
Votes aye.
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 Votes aye. Having received the affirmative, we'll move the dash two amendments into House Bill 3090, and we'll close the public work session on House Bill 3090.
May I have a comment before we do? I assume there are going to be some amendments to this, at least I hope they are, particularly around the gathering question. But I would also like to comment that it would be very useful if we had alleged counsel let us know on the section 3 of 9 in the hand-engrossed version. We had a comment by a county clerk that a contest of election form would allow that to be taken to the court. I'm not convinced that's the case. I've been reading 258, 211, and my impression is if 3 goes into 211, it will define for the courts that ballots are not to be counted. And I'm not sure what basis the court would then have to make a statement that they ought to be counted. And I think it would be pretty important for us to understand the context of this section 3, section 9, sub 3, section 9 of 258211, and make sure that this is really what it is intended to be. And if the sponsors really say if they find a 1,000 ballots somewhere when it comes time to a recount, they don't want those honest-to-God, real ballots of our electors counted, I think we have a significant problem.
Thank you for pointing that out so eloquently, and I'm sure the authors of that bill will be more than happy to address that in their offices. Thank you. Public hearing closed. We'll open a public work session, excuse me, on House Bill 3238. We have 17 people wishing to testify. I'm sorry?
Is it a work session? Should I get the memo from there?
I'm sorry, we're opening a public hearing on House Bill 3238. Colleagues, we have 17 people signed up to testify for this bill. Anybody wishing to simply submit their written testimony for the record in lieu of time. It is greatly appreciated. Corey thinks that she's going to read through every one of those books back there. She's crazy. So,
just the ones that have OARs in them.
Colleagues, committee is scheduled to end at 3 o'clock. We will gauge it by ear depending on how far we get along when that time comes. So, with that, Representative Thatcher. Excuse me, we'll let Cletus read the bill summary.
Mr. Chair and Committee, HB 3238 permits standing committees of Legislative Assembly to review temporary pending and final agency rules, permits Legislative Assembly to adopt concurrent resolution to adopting approving rule or rejection or amending rule, makes pending rules effective at conclusion of session of Legislative Assembly during which rule is submitted for review, prevents agency intended action from remaining in effect beyond date of Legislative Assembly, amends or rejects rule, requires agency to implement legislative intent as expressed in concurrent resolution, makes all administrative rules expire every 2 years unless extended by statute.
Thank you, Cletus. Representative Thatcher.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I did prepare some remarks, but I am anxious also to hear from some of the people who are here to testify. But so I'll cut this a little shorter. Essentially, administrative rules carry the full effect of law. However, many times they're implemented without sufficient public input. Oregon has prided itself on its landmark open public meetings laws. However, most of the regulations that affect our daily lives were enacted behind closed doors by bureaucrats that are neither elected nor appointed to represent citizens. Each session, nearly 3,500 bills are introduced by the legislative process. And I would ask you how many legislators you think completely understand the implications of each of those bills that finally end up making it to the floor. Just look at the speed zone law for school zones. The function of the rulemaking process, I asked Secretary of State's office how many rules there were in effect, and they couldn't tell me, but they did tell me that there's at least 10,000 pages. Picture a ream of paper, 500 pages thick, picture 20 of them. That's how many rules there are in effect right now in 7 to 9 point font, very small. So there are very many, many rules to deal with. In House Bill 3238, if we amend it with the dash 3 amendments, as I'm proposing, it would add a common sense process to the process by which agencies promulgate rules, requiring agents to provide a simple 15-word caption for each rule, similar to the ballot title process, and a plain English summary that would put the pieces of the puzzle together as to which ORS statute they are implementing and along with the proposed rule, so you can match it up. And the amendments would also require agencies, in considering the cost of compliance, to project the time, effort, and financial resources that could be expended by the public in conforming with the rule, somewhat similar to the Federal Paperwork Reduction Act. Essentially, the goal of it is to provide the public access to the rulemaking process and bring some more transparency to our governance. It was not difficult to find people who have been negatively impacted by rules, and it's not necessarily large groups of people we're talking about, not big businesses. We're talking small businesses that may or may not be represented well by associations, etc. Just the other weekend, just 2 weekends ago, while I was out of town on committee meetings for some committee, mystery, I don't know which one, my husband was going to take my three-year-old to the trout pond that we had taken our older children to when they were young. When he got there, they were disappointed to find that this place was closed. And the owner told my husband, unbeknownst, didn't know who he was, nor who I was and what I was working on, told him that they were driven out of business by the cost of compliance with administrative rules. In fact, there are only three left in the state now out of 24. So we're not talking about a large constituency, but we are talking about the fact that most of these businesses were driven out of business, and I don't think that was intent, but there needs to be a vehicle in place to engage the public, and that's what I'm trying to do with amendments to the House Bill 3238. Thank you.
Representative Thatcher, March.
Thank you. We tend to get one of these bills virtually every session, and then we start looking at 10,000 pages of OARs and what it would take to review those. But I also am concerned about the breadth that on page 7 of your dash 3s, and I'm sorry I didn't get a chance, I came by your office to talk to you about this, but you'd gotten called away. On page 7 dash 3s, we're talking about the mailing lists, and it says, starting on line 3, in addition, the agency shall make good faith efforts to identify any person potentially affected by the adoption, amendment, or repeal of a rule, and include the person in the mailing list. And I was thinking, well, the state Board of Higher Education, if they decide to change the graduate requirements for someone going to an OUS system, has a large number of people who might potentially be affected by that. Everybody from a baby just born and not yet deciding to go to college to all the way up through if you're in high school or just applied. And maybe we need, I see what you're trying to get to. You're trying to make it known that there are changes afoot out there, or potential changes afoot, and how do you get public input? And just as the gentleman with the trout farm or the fishing pond, he could have contacted the legislature. We could have probably changed some laws and gotten those rules changed. But how do you get people into that? And I don't, this is going to place a tremendous burden on a lot of agencies.
Well, I would say it would be consistent with an existing statute that says that the Legislative Assembly encourages agencies to seek public input to the maximum extent possible. I was just trying to clarify that, in that we need to not just wait for people to come to the agencies to express an interest in hearing how rules, might be changed or repealed or amended, but actually putting forth a little extra effort to see that, I know we are DHS, for instance, but there might be some businesses out there affected by this. And if there are, then maybe they could utilize the resources that are available through the Secretary of State to identify those businesses.
Okay. Thank you. And just one quick follow-up, and that's, if you're trying to get to the businesses that are negatively affected by this, maybe we can look at the scope of this, and I'd be happy to get together with you and talk some more.
Sure. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Thatcher. Seeing no further questions, we'll get down to the testimony. If we can do our best to keep the testimony under 3 minutes, that looks like about the time that we have. I realize that there may be some questions that will arise out of the testimony, but let's do our best to get through the 17 people that are wishing to testify. So at this time, I'll call forward. We'll go 3 at a time, if that's okay. Robert Kervan?
Caravan.
Shane Griggs? A change is good and wait. You and Phil and Corey and Julie can all come up at the same time. Okay. If you could provide 25 copies of your documentation for the. Appreciate you doing that.
In front of his door when he's there.
Robert, please state your name for the record. And.
Mr. Chair and committee, thank you for the privilege. My name is Robert E. Caravan from Bridgeview Vineyards. I'm a farmer from Southern Oregon. I farm grapes. I think this bill, 3238, is a bill that will rein in the rogue agencies like the DSL that keep breaking Oregon's Constitution, Article 1, Section 21, and Article 3, Section 1. regarding the separation of power. The legislature cannot delegate this power to make new law, and thus the administrative agencies cannot make new law. The legislature can delegate the executive branch the power to further define, fill in gaps, and interpret structures consistent with the intent of the statute adopted by the legislature. I only have experience with the DSL, so my testimony is about that experience. The DSL deliberately, and I use that word twice, deliberately, changes the meaning of words and phrases in the definition section of the OAR. The phrase such as activities normally associated with agriculture are exempt under ORS 196-800 to 196-905. They have changed that to, in the ORAs, OARs, I'm sorry, that the terminology activities normally associated with agriculture means less than 50 cubic yards. That completely does away with the exemption. The phrase has been ruled in court in three separate court incidents to be the farm exemption is limited in bounds. Push-up dams are an exempt activity under 196-905, Circle 6. It reads that they cannot significantly adversely affect waters to a greater extent than were affected as a result of the original construction. The DSL has interpreted this to mean size. The DSL knows that to install a push-up dam, a farmer must chase the water in the riverbed. Water sources do not remain constant, making it impossible to construct a dam exactly in the same size, extent, and location as it was before the channel changing event. Adding to the testimony nullifies the exemption. Roads, maintenance of farm roads are exempt under 196-905, Circle 4B, under OAR 141085-0010, Circle 10. Maintenance does not include reconstruction. Under 141085-0020, Circle 5, regarding farm road maintenance activities, shall be contained in the original approved structure. ORS 196905, Circle 4B, makes no mention of the original approval structure. In the Owens case, the appeals court disagreed with the DSL's rule and found in favor of Owens. Appeal hearings regarding assistance from an individual, issuance from an individual fill removal permit, the law states that any person aggrieved or adversely affected by the grant of a permit may file a written request for hearing. It goes on to say that if the director finds that the person has requested a legally protected interest which is adversely affected by the grant of the permit, the director may set the matter down for hearing. DSL OAR states that persons who do not have legal protected interests may nevertheless be included in the contested case hearing. The DSL's OAR give the right of to the alternative dispute solution process. The applicant, the farmer in this case, who filed for the permit, gets to share the cost of the mediator. This is not the law. DSL has introduced HB 2082 and its sister bill SB 170 in this session. If it passed, it would completely revamp the fill and removal law. in this SB 170, they are granting themselves the authority in statute to adopt by administrative rule best management practices of the exemption activities. The director may review and revise the BMP adopted pursuant to this subsection. By the way, according to the March 25th Capital Press, HB 2082 is on its last legs. Prior to the 2005 legislature, the same law called assumption was brought up in 2001 as SB 172 and again in 2003 as SB 219. Even though the law has not passed during those three sessions, the last three sessions, the DSL has spent thousands, and I say hundreds of thousands of dollars, building the OARs to cover the assumption bill at the expense of the Oregon school funds. By doing so, they have exceeded the statutory authority of the agency. And I would like to add that I think that it's time that somebody brought them under control. I was very nice when I said, called them rogue. They've arrested me. I've spent $350,000 protecting myself. They've threatened me to make a felon out of me. They have threatened other farmers the same way. They're a rogue agency by all means.
I appreciate your
any questions?
I just want one clarification. I understand that the courts did come down on your side eventually, but it cost you a lot of money in the process.
Yes. Well, it's not the money that has cost me. The problem is the little guy has to cop a plea because he can't fight City Hall. And all of a sudden they run up against somebody with some bucks. And if they made a felon out of me, I make alcohol for a living. I would lose my federal license to make alcohol. So I had no alternative but to fight. And then I woke up, and I agree with one of the representatives, I think it was Representative Marks, said, how do we get the people involved? And all of a sudden, I was forced to get involved. And when I saw what is going on, I have spent a lot of my personal time trying to bring this to the attention of the legislature. I have been told right to my face by high up people in DSL that you suck up to the legislature all you want for 6 months, but the next 18 months is you got to deal with us. And that's how they feel. So I think it's up to put some restraints on it. I think some of the things that they're doing is down in my neighborhood, it's almost, I know some people would shoot them for it.
Representative Marks.
Just a short one. I do appreciate your wines. You put out a very nice product. Have you had more recent dealings with Division of State Lands? They're under sort of new management, and I wondered if things have changed any.
I have the Division of State Lands under an injunction that the court gave me. They held court on my property, and the judge said you'd have to be a blind man not to see the damage being done to the caravan property, and we were given an injunction. Ann Hannis didn't like that. Afterwards, she put in a derogatory news release that we tricked the DSL with a high-class lawyer, and that we tricked them so they could not appeal, and she doesn't know the law. They brought me under criminal law, and you can't file and be double jeopardy, and that's a law that's been in effect since 1776. She just learned that about 2 years ago. But the main thing is the little guy. That's the one that gets hurt, not me.
Thank you.
Appreciate you being here and coming all the way up. And I also a big fan of your product. You put out a great product and make Oregon proud nationwide. So appreciate you.
You pay a lot of taxes too.
Yes, you do. We're going to try and help you out with that too, just in a different committee.
Shane, Phil, Julie. Ready to go. Please state your name.
7 seconds.
8 minutes.
Chair Kitts, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Shane Griggs. I'm with the Department of Administrative Services. I'm here today to share with my coworkers some of our concerns, agency's concerns on HB 3238 in its original format. We're aware that there are Dash 3 amendments now, but I only received those mid-morning, so I don't feel comfortable addressing those specifically at this point. But so just some highlights of the original bill. I'll keep my comments very brief. There are several policy and process issues raised with that original bill, as are there some constitutional separation of roles questions that we have with the bill. One concern is that although the current rulemaking process allows and promotes public participation in the rulemaking by all affected parties, the original bill doesn't seem to include that opportunity. Julie with Secretary of State's office will deal with that in a moment. She'll also point to the avenues of recourses that are available to affected parties if they feel that the rules have compromised the original intent of the bill. Secondly, is the concern that the separate roles of the legislative and executive branches aren't maintained with the provisions of the original bill. An additional concern is the proposed process does present somewhat of an awkward situation when theoretically following the passage of a bill and the presentation of a rule by an agency, there's about an 18-month lag period during which time the rule's only temporarily in effect. It wouldn't be until after the next session adjourns, convenes, that they would either amend or approve that administrative rules. Just also for the record, David Reese from the governor's office, Julie and I shared these concerns with Representative Kitts' office yesterday as sort of a heads up. And I'm going to turn it over. I'd be glad to answer questions, but I think most of those are going to be answered by Julie Yamaka and Phil Schrader. So I will, if there are no questions, I'm not sure which is chairing it.
Oh, I am. I don't know. Are there any questions? Okay. Thank you.
Thanks.
Well, thank you. Thanks, Chair Thatcher, members of the committee. I'm Julie Yamaka. I'm the manager of the Administrative Rules Unit at the Archives Division of the Secretary of State's office. Several issues here about House Bill 3238. House Bill 3238 would allow the Legislative Assembly to adopt, amend, and repeal administrative rules. This would effectively change every administrative rule into a bill. Your bill provides for the expiration, wholesale expiration and review of the 10,000 pages of administrative rules every 2 years. That would be a problem for our office in that the public... Am I working on her 7 minutes?
Yeah.
Go ahead. Keep going, please.
Oh, dear. Okay. That expiration or that wholesale repeal of rules would be a problem for the public in knowing what rules were in effect at any given time. It seems like things would be in limbo for a period of time. Currently, the process for administrative rules. To give an idea of the number of rules reviewed by legislative councils, 13 staff attorneys now, during the first three quarters of the current biennium, there were 14,391 permanent and temporary administrative rule adoptions, amendments, and repeals sent to legislative council and filed with the Secretary of State's office. Currently, members of the legislature and the legislative committees may have legislative council review rules for compliance with legislation and can submit comments directly to the agencies. That's something that's a possibility now. Legislative council currently reviews all newly adopted and amended permanent and temporary rules for consistency within the intent and scope of statutory authority. And the last section I have is on Oregon's APA. ORS Chapter 183 establishes the requirements for rulemaking, including public notice, public comment, and statutory review by legislative council. In brief, the legislators pass the bills that direct the agencies. The agencies implement the acts by writing the administrative rules. agency subject matter experts and their administrative rule advisory committees. Typically, those advisory committees are made up of interested, affected parties. They draft the rule text on which the affected community provides input and comments. Typically, draft text is modified during the public comment and hearings process and finalized after the last date for public comment. Then the final rules are filed with the Secretary of State's office, our office, and published in the Oregon Bulletin and the OAR compilation. I've set along with me today. And filed with Legislative Council for statutory review. In addition, ORS 183.390 and OAR Chapter 137, Division 1, Rule 70 provide that any interested person may petition any agency to adopt, amend, or repeal a rule. And that's all I have. If you have questions, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Good job.
Chair Kitts, members of the committee, my name is Philip Schradel. I'm special counsel to the Attorney General. I have comments about the original proposal, very quickly on the Dash 3 amendments, and then a suggestion for some forward-looking work. On the original bill, we were quite concerned because it established that bills would only be effective if after the passage of a concurrent resolution by the Legislative Assembly.
Does the amendment change that?
Yes. That, well, there still is contained a little bit in the Dash 3 amendments. And the concern that we have about that is if it's supposed to be a binding statement of law, that can't be done through a concurrent resolution, but would need to be done through a bill. The question that I have on the Dash 3 amendments is there's still a provision about the concurrent resolution, and it is to provide direction to the agencies. I think we need to have further conversation about whether that is intended to be a direction of binding effect or a direction that is more hortatory, just encouraging. So I would encourage us to have an ongoing conversation about how to accomplish the intent there. The other big concern that I want to express about the Dash 3 amendments is the, and Representative March raised this question about the mailing list requirement. The example that came to my mind, kind of the horror story, was what if the Department of Motor Vehicles wished to change something about the license renewal application process? I think under the current terms of the bill, that would require a mailing to every licensed driver in the state of Oregon. Now, that could be accomplished. The question is whether that's what you really want to have happen and whether you want to, and I think we want to narrow that a bit. Now, the proposal that I'd have on a forward-going basis is House Bill 3120 that was passed by this Legislative Assembly last session established the Advisory Committee on Agency Rule Streamlining. Department of Consumer and Business Services Director Corey Streisinger, who I have as my alter ego today a bit, she authorized me to make some representations about that. I participated in that process, too. The goal behind that was following up on the governor's executive order about agency rule streamlining. That group met. It was a broad consensus or a work group. It was comprised of entities like Department of Consumer Business Services, legislative advocates, Tom Gallagher was the vice chair, United Energy, Department of Environmental Quality, Lane County Legal Aid, PGE, private citizens, J.L. Wilson, who I think will provide testimony here, too. The outcome of that group led to House Bill 2188, which is also in this session, that gets at some of the same issues. I believe the speaker has introduced House Bill 2003, which also gets at some of these issues. And I would suggest we kind of come at it with a coordinated approach. There's some language in here that would serve the same purposes as others' bills. There are things that go beyond it, like primarily some of the overbreadth concerns that have been expressed. So I'd encourage an ongoing discussion about that.
Great. Thank you.
I tried.
You did. Appreciate it. See no questions. Appreciate you being here. We'll, in light of some of the concerns and the varying parties that are involved here, we'll probably be establishing some form of a work group at the end of this with a specific time frame dealing with this topic so that it doesn't get put off until the interim or next session, which is generally what happens. So we'll probably be establishing a work group with a time certain on this as we go forward and these concerns are raised. I'm just going to say Gene. I guess the odds of pronouncing your last name are slim to none. Sharman. Richard Burke and Ann Reistrom.
you could try to keep it within the time frame. And I only put this timer up there so that you get some semblance of how long. It's obviously not a hard time.
Well, good afternoon, Chair Kitts, members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to testify this afternoon. For the record, my name is Jean Showerman. I'm here on behalf of Sandra Bishop, who represents the Fair Competition Alliance, FCA. The FCA is a nonprofit association with both business and labor union members. FCA has for many years been negotiating with the Department of Administrative Services to demand proper implementation and oversight of ORS 279.835 through 279.855, the products of disabled individual law. We are here today in support of the concept behind House Bill 3238. FCA has not been able to complete a thorough review of all of the provisions and legal implications of the bill, but we wholeheartedly support the concept behind more accountability in the rulemaking process. Today, we would like to enter into the committee record a copy of administrative rules governing the products of disabled individual shelters. This law is part of the public contracting code. It mandates that a public contract must be awarded without competitive bid to a nonprofit organization that employs the disabled. The statutory authority for exemption to competitive bidding has been in Oregon law since 1977. The statute itself is less than 3 pages in length. From 1977 to the year 2003, administrative rules for this statute were a total of 4 pages in length. Today, we have a set of rules that is 27 pages in length. Division 55, State Purchasing 125-055-0005 through 125-055-0130. This is a prime example of a state agency abusing their rulemaking power by putting into rule processes and procedures that have been challenged by industry and labor as beyond the scope of authority in the underlying statute. Department of Administrative Services has attempted to codify and legitimize their standard operating procedures, which are in conflict with statute. Some sort of oversight of rulemaking is needed to respect legislative intent. Thank you.
Thank you. Ann, why don't you go ahead and go next, and just, if you could summarize this and not read it verbatim, we'll submit it into the record, and I appreciate your thoroughness, but if you could summarize that as a lot of time would be greatly appreciated.
All right. My name's Ann Reistrom, and I'm with Clear Creek Rainbow Ranch, a top farm up in Oregon City. I'm also treasurer of Oregon Aquaculture Association, which was recently formed in September of 2004 in response to Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife mandating some fish policy health rules for all the farms. They were going to require that all fish farms at their own expense do mandatory health testing every year. And I've got in here, you know, which, you know, OARS that comes from. The response from Oregon aquaculturists was that they could not afford to do that. They could not afford what would happen if they tested positive to these tests. There are no written rules about what will happen to your farm. We've been told that we'd have to divert water around our farm, and that some of the farms just can't afford to do that or to do the testing, and so they've decided not to produce fish anymore. There's no way to appeal these kind of things. I mean, you appeal them to Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, and you're appealing it to Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. You know, I mean, if they want to make the rules, they're going to make the rules. They've changed our propagation licenses from 1 year to the next without giving us any written notice or explaining to us why those are changed. We have 3 or 4 bills over in the Senate right now because we did get together as a group and say that we needed to change these. If there was a way to appeal these OARSs or to deal with an agency other than trying to do a new law, I think that it would be helpful to a small business person. We don't have the money to do a lobbyist every year. Right now we're trying to get a few laws taken care of so that we can continue to function in the state. We are trying to set up an advisory committee to help watch out for us, but to have some agency or some way to review what the departments are doing that's not just by the department, I think would really benefit small business people in Oregon, and specifically fish farmers.
And would the work group that we're going to set up be something that you'd be interested in serving on?
Yes. Okay. Let me look at fish farming.
Thank you.
Richard.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Richard Burke. I'm the Executive Director for the Libertarian Party of Oregon, and the Libertarian Party supports House Bill 3238. One reason is because we do believe that the bill is good for business. Whether it is deserved or not, Oregon does have a reputation throughout the nation as being a state hostile to business. The administrative rule process is one reason why. We deal with a lot of small business people. A lot of our members own small businesses, including restaurants, veterinary hospitals, boxing and moving companies, and we constantly hear about how administrative rules are making their lives miserable. And not only in my current venue of the Libertarian Party, but also when I worked for Senator George. I heard repeatedly what the gentleman who owned the winery said, that we deal with the legislature for 6 months, and the agencies have them for the other 18 months. We have two legislative branches in this state, and that just isn't right. It undermines the legitimacy of our system of governance, and in the long run, is not good for our democracy, it's not good for our economy, and, you know, I am sympathetic to the fact that if a bill like this passes, the legislature will have a lot of work to do, and there are going to be things that are cumbersome. But I don't think I have to tell any of you that that kind of work comes with this job. Such is the fate of he who would be king, I guess, is the saying that I've often heard. And I know that you can handle it. Some have suggested that the people wouldn't be able to follow the bills. Well, I have found that when their interests are involved, people are very adept at following their interests. I had an experience in college that I'd like to relate to you that deals with this.
It was a quick experience.
A very quick experience. When I was in student government at University of Nebraska, the Incidental Fee Committee gave its funding recommendations to the Student Senate as a bill that had to be passed. Every student group was therefore involved with the Senate and engaged, and it was a healthy student government. At Portland State, the Incidental Fee Committee was completely independent, didn't have to go through the Senate. Everyone dealt with them, and the Student Senate was dysfunctional, was irrelevant, and no one paid attention to it. Now, the relationship between you and the agencies isn't as starkly delineated as that, but the same dynamic is at work. It makes them less responsive to legislators, which is something that Senator George experienced as chair of the General Government and Transportation Committee in 01, and I've heard a lot of other legislators say that as well. Passing this bill will solve a lot of these problems, would be good for business, good for our democratic process, good for the legislature, and good for the state. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Richard. Appreciate your brevity. See no questions. Thank you very much. And we'll have a sign-up sheet for the work group on that bill. Thank you. At this time, we'll call forward Darrell Fuller, Mark Carson, and Peter Grapple.
That's one up.
Get a meat sandwich, Darrell. But you get to go first.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Darrell Fuller for the record. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Auto Dealers Association and the Oregon Small Business Coalition. I got to tell you, I love administrative rules. I know you're going to be surprised to hear that. But 8 years ago, the auto dealers were represented by a contract lobbyist by the name of Ray Gribling, who was retiring. The auto dealers had to decide what they were going to do with his retirement, and they had a long-range planning meeting. And they came to the conclusion that managing our interests in the legislature was a relatively easy process. You hired a lobbyist, and they were there during the session. But it was impossible for the dealers to manage all of the administrative rules that were coming through that were impacting auto dealers, so they had to hire a full-time lobbyist instead of a contract lobbyist. And so I am employed today because of administrative rules, and so I want to tell you how much I appreciate that there are some of them out there. On the other hand, administrative rules can be both good and bad depending on how they're done. Frankly, the legislature is responsible for a lot of the administrative rules that you don't see because of the permissive authority that you give state agencies. A very good example of that is the Unfair Trade Practices Act, which does impact Auto Dealers Association. I'll read briefly from 646-608. An unlawful business trade practice proof the Attorney General's rules. A person engages in an unlawful practice when in the course of the person's business, vocation, or occupation, the person does any of the following. Sub U in that very long list of things is engages in any other unfair or deceptive conduct in trade or commerce. And that leaves it to the Attorney General's office to decide what is any other unfair or deceptive conduct. The legislature provides language that invites administrative rules to be written. to the degree that that happens. And by the way, there are times that us as lobby request that the legislature provide that authority so that we can work with the agency in creating the rules, and those are usually situations where we're participating with the agency in adopting the rules. It does happen in the obverse in some cases where the agency just does it on their own and doesn't invite participation by the affected industry. I can tell you to the degree that the agencies solicit input, the administrative rules go a long way. But I think it is important that you guys, as you provide administrative rules, administrative agencies with the authority to write rules, that there ought to be some sort of trigger that would allow affected industries to say, hey, wait a minute, this isn't what we were asking about, this isn't what we expected, and that they ought to be able to go to the citizens' representatives. And while the previous testimony indicated that the authority is there for citizens on their own to provide or request information, I think that it would be to everyone's advantage to have a specific trigger in the law that would give us an opportunity to appeal to the legislature administrative rules that we believe are necessarily overburdening. I appreciate your time.
General, thank you. Mark?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mark Carson. That's Carson with a K. And I have the uniqueness, I guess you'd say, of having the oldest liquor store in the state of Oregon. I think I have a secondary uniqueness is in the early 90s, I was told by, at that time, the commission that there were more administrative rules written because of my store than anything else in the Liquor Commission. Now, I find that hard to believe, but I'm the type of person that believes in rules and wants to know my boundaries. And the Liquor Commission, every time I find something that isn't a boundary, they put a fence around me. Now, almost 6 years ago, they violated my contract. We do not have a license. We're contracted, and they violated it along with several other liquor agents. And I filed a lawsuit. Well, we won about 75% of that lawsuit because legally they violated the contract, the laws of the contract. The remaining 25% went to the Court of Appeals because we had a pro tem judge. He decided, or they decided after a couple of months of deliberation, that we were a unique and separate class of people created by the legislature. And they did not have authority to rule over this case. So, in part, that's why I'm before you. I'm looking for some understanding since you created me and the other 240-some liquor stores. Now, I have the history, not only the oldest store, but some uniqueness. In the late 70s, or in 76, the Liquor Commission formed what they called they were taking state stores and forming the agencies there, which had already been in existence since 1934, but they were converting the big stores, which meant they were converting stores in major populated areas. By the late 70s, 79, we were selling related items. We were selling Schweppes mixer and pop and margarita mixer and glasses and that. Everything went along with the liquor store, which liquor stores had been doing so since 1934. But Roger Martin, who was lobbyist for United Grocers and next-door neighbor to Chairman Hedlin, got together with John Passantini, owner of Plaid Pantries, and Southland Corporation. They could not coerce any of the major liquor stores. And they put pressure by writing letters to the governor, to the legislature, and to the Liquor Commission saying that if we could sell related items, then they should be able to sell hard liquor. Well, Chairman Hedlund decided that he was going to create an administrative rule called related items that restricted what we sold. Now, I find it strange. There were six stores that were cited in the late 70s. The rule took effect in 81. And they went to Eastern Oregon in a commission meeting to create this administrative rule. And then, as been stated, it took several months to work out the details. During that time, I was asked some questions, and I found it kind of interesting, keeping in mind the lawsuit, because am I a state employee, am I a contract employee, or am I an independent contractor? The questions they wanted to know prior to the enactment of the administrative rule was, do I sell related items to licensees or other businesses at the present time? What are the related items you sell? What is your markup when selling related items? Do you offer full case or quantity discount? Do you sell all related items at the same price? Do you deliver related items? Do you keep records of purchases and sales of related items? Would you make those records available by the audit of the commission? Lastly, what are your plans after January 1st, 1981 regarding the aforementioned activities? Will you be in compliance with the OR? They know I have to be in compliance, but they're telling me how to micromanage my business, and I'm called an independent contractor. I mean, something's amiss here. And as the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court ruled that they didn't have jurisdiction over me, this committee, in my opinion, is the perfect place to address administrative rules and my livelihood. The reason I bring these issues up is the state has, again, started the store within a store system. They're putting liquor stores inside a grocery store. Now, isn't this the reversal of the argument of the late 70s? If grocery stores can have liquor, why can't I have related items, beer and wine? And, you know, it's strange that the law, another administrative rule, says that bars in their off-kitchen hours shall provide items as chips. Yeah, I've got it in front of me if I can't find it. Chips, nuts, pretzels, peanuts, popcorn. If you've been in a bar, you know what I'm talking about. Now, the Liquor Commission in 1OR requires bars to sell that, and yet they forbid us as non-related. I can tell you why. In the late 70s, Frito-Lay said, I sold more Frito-Lay products. I had a triple rack than a major grocery store. I sold more cigarettes than Fred Meyer's just down the street, three blocks from me. I sold more pop. I was the number one Schweppes retailer in the state of Oregon. Now, why? I'm a good businessman. But it seems like every time I've tried to improve my life, the Liquor Commission has created a related items rule that says I can't. Now they're putting liquor in the grocery stores. Let's give the liquor stores some freedom.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Peter Greenfoot. I have a liquor store in Eugene, and I'd like to basically follow up on the same rule. It's 845-015-0143. It's a related item rule that was created by the Liquor Commission. And just to show you how weird these situations can get, that in the 1980s we had a situation where it had become obvious to the Budget Committee that handled agents' compensation that we needed more money because our expenses had gone up. But there was no more money for us to give in the budget. So at that time, Senator Thorne from Pendleton suggested to allow agents to sell more related items and thereby earn their own money instead of relying on the budget. And because of this administrative rule in place that limited the rights of agents to sell more, OLCC saw fit not to make any changes. This was done against proven economic need and against legislative desire and recommendation. At the same time, they did not allow us to sell beer and wine, because this rule was still on the books. On the other hand, they chose to issue 500 licenses to sell beer and wine to gas stations, thereby indirectly promoting drinking and driving. We have absolutely the best record of control of sales to minors and intoxicated people in our liquor stores. There was a period where grocery stores received 1,500 violations for selling to minors, and liquor stores received 6. And still, we as agents are not a large enough economic force to hire high-priced lobbyists and to get some improvements. Our income is very limited because of budget concerns, and I would urge this committee to take a strong look at putting some overview and some periodic reviews on these administrative rules, because they've gone plumb out of hand. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your testimony. No questions. Thank you. This time we'll call. Is Rob Kramer around? call Robert Hesla, J.L. Wilson, and Don Schellenberg. Appreciate your patience.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, J.L. Wilson, representing the National Federation of Independent Business with 12,000 employers statewide. You know, the compliance with regulation is a top three issue for our membership alongside taxes and the cost of health insurance. It's been that way for the past 10 or 15 years, which is to say it's a huge issue. And when you think about all 12,000 of my members, all of whom are governed by a handful of agencies and the rules that are accompany that, some of which are governed by half dozen or more state agencies. So you see where it becomes a problem. Just in Representative Smith's subcommittee on small business, a gal who owns Hannah B's Pound Cake from Portland, an African-American woman who started up that business, said, "I'm governed by 6, 7, 8 agencies, and most of the time it feels like I'm working for the state of Oregon." And that's exactly the constituency that I represent. And the reason we support House Bill 3238 and the Dash 3 amendments is simply an issue of recourse for a small business owner when there is a disconnect between legislative intent and what is actually promulgated as a rule by the agency. And I'm very concerned about issues of recourse. It's very attractive to a business because obviously I represent the little guy who has to run a business in compliance with rules from various agencies, and if something goes awry and costs him time and money that shouldn't be there, he should have some avenue of recourse. And that is why we support the committee proposal in the Dash 3 amendments. I would also hope that the issue is attractive to the legislature, where you can force some accountability for following legislative intent when it comes to the rulemaking process. Now, having said that, we do support the Dash 3 amendments to this bill. I also want to say, as a participant in the House Bill 3120 work group, I do feel that there has been an earnest effort made in the executive branch to help deal with these issues, but I don't think that you can possibly bring enough attention to this subject, which is why we really endorse this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, J.L. Thank you for testimony. Robert?
Well, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bob Hesla. I'm also a liquor agent, and I'm going to try and succinctly summarize what the previous two liquor agents said. And basically, next month, the May Commission meeting for the OLCC, they are going to rule as to whether they want to open up the related item issue. Three agents and 99 citizens asked that they allow liquor stores to sell beer and wine, and at that time, I expect that they will turn us down. The problem that I see with agencies and administrative rules is that in the case of the OLCC, they're all political appointments. Only one of those five members of that commission has any practical business experience. And so any decision that they make on whether we can sell related items or not is based on all political concerns. It has nothing to do with maybe increasing traffic flow into those stores, increasing more sales of distilled spirits, which makes more profit for the state. Last year, or the last biennium, actually it's this biennium because it doesn't end until June, Oregon state liquor store retailers will sell approximately $600 million worth of liquor. And the state's profit out of that, so what comes back to cities and counties, the Wine Advisory Board and the General Fund, is about $400 million. And there's no reason why liquor agents who are paid 8% on what they sell, and that's the average, that's not what the highest guy makes. The highest one makes 21% because it's a non-exclusive in a small town. And the lowest one makes about 6%, and that's a liquor store that does over $6 million worth of sales. We're all governed by these political appointees who step over pennies to pick or step over dollars to pick up pennies every day of the week. So hopefully that summarized it for you. I thank you for your time, and I need to go because my parking meter is going to run out.
Thank you, Bob. And if you get a ticket, just give it to JL. He can get lots of money.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Don Schellenberg representing Oregon Farm Bureau. I want to just briefly here say, too, our support for House Bill 3238 and the -3 amendments. I was testifying this morning before the House Elections Committee. Or is that where I'm at today?
That's where you're at now.
That's where I'm at now. Who was I? Representative Hovley was there this morning.
Was I? Jeez, I can't keep track of where I've been.
Anyway, I was testifying on at that point on HJR 43, which would give probably a little more authority, I think, for dealing with administrative rules than what I would even be comfortable with. There is an issue of separation of powers that you have to maintain. We're a strong supporter of that. And so consequently, you do have administrative rules, but what runs awry, of course, is when you have people in those administration, in those agencies who maybe have an agenda that they keep pushing no matter what the no matter what the legislation was, they're able to work their way around it. So if it comes to House HJR 43, you ever get to that, I'd like to testify on that as well. But just let me conclude by saying again, offering our support for 3238-3 amendments. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Appreciate your conclusion. Committee? Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate you being here. Seeing no further people to testify on this bill, I can close the public hearing on House Bill 3238. And, oh, I'm just kidding. At this time, anything for the good of the order? Committee, thank you for your patience. Members out in the public, thank you for your patience. It was a long committee, and Representative Holby and I have another committee. It starts at 4 o'clock. So,
right here.
Adjourned.
Well, you don't have to get up, probably, except to move.